You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2024 Vuelta a España from Lisboa to Madrid.
Buenas tardes, Richard from the... That's young Richard Abraham, by the way. From the aluminium factory, the Cortizo. It's not actually an aluminium factory. I'm doing them a disservice. It's a technological campus, Richard. And it is quite impressive, I must say. I've never said that before about a technological campus.
Buenas tardes.
Aluminium plant.
Danny, tell me something. Tell me something interesting about aluminium smelting technology today. Did you get a press pack with all the kind of info on how many tons of aluminium it produces?
No, we didn't even get that. And I was too lazy to do the necessary research to impart that kind of information. I did do a bit of research about Cortizo, the company who have obviously paid a lot of money, first of all, to sponsor the Vuelta a España, and then to lure the Vuelta a España, start the Vuelta a España into their backyard here in Patrón, in Galicia. And it appears this was quite a small, well, it was a sort of one-man band company that started up in the 70s, I believe. They were carpenters initially, and somehow they got on to making window frames, and there was a construction boom in Salamanca, which is nowhere near here. Windows and aluminium windows, or actually I forget at this point whether it was the aluminium or the PVC, because Cortizo makes both, they were in huge demand in Salamanca, so they were shipping enormous quantities or transporting enormous quantities of their PVC or aluminium down to Salamanca, and they basically got very, very rich in a very short space of time. That was my reading of the story anyway. And this campus is quite extraordinary. It reminds me a bit, we had a start and finish, indeed, no, it was a finish last year at the Techno Gym campus. Techno Gym make gym equipment, and they are based in Cesena or Cesenatico, one of the two. And we had a finish there, and we ate in the staff canteen, and this was very similar today. But what was most impressive was that Cortizo seemed to have invited, well, all of their employees, but an inordinate number of people here. And it was like, I've never been to Glastonbury, Richard, but it was like what I imagine Glastonbury to be like, sort of, kind of, without the music.
I've not been either. Maybe let's drop that metaphor. I'm trying to think about some similarities between Glastonbury and Stage 12. What are we on? Stage 11 of the Vuelta in an aluminium technological campus.
Yeah, people worshipping at the altar of PVC rather than rock music, if you can imagine that. It seems to be a pretty well put on event. A great day for everyone who was here. We can question the sort of the legitimacy of these starts and finishes and sponsors, as we saw with Carrefour and Stage 6. And we're having the luxury of bringing the Vuelta a España onto their premises and turning it into just a big love-in for the company. But I'm sure, as far as they're concerned, today was a roaring success. And I'm sure lots of people probably listening to this podcast will be nipping down the local shops to buy some Cortizo PVC or aluminium.
Yeah.
As we speak. Richard, I said we're in Padrón of pepper fame, and Pimientos de Padrón. I've been reading about them today as well. Maybe more on that later. But were we going to have a spicy day on the Vuelta a España? That was the question. I think, Richard, without giving anything away, we can say pretty emphatically that it was a spicy day, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a saying. I did a bit of Padrón pepper research as well. I haven't eaten any today. Unfortunately,
I know what you're going to say.
Go do on. You?
The famous, yeah.
Is it a famous saying? I don't know how famous it is. I'd not heard it before, but that's because I'm not really, I haven't heard a lot of Galician sayings before. But is the same one that you're thinking of? Os pimentos de padrón, uns pican e outros non. Is that it?
That's it.
That's
yes,
the one.
Yes.
It's not as good in English. Padrón peppers, some are hot and some are not.
And this is applicable to any situation in life where, you know, it's kind of you win some, you lose some sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think that's the gist of it.
It's vague enough, isn't it? You can pretty much apply that saying to anything you want, I would imagine.
Indeed. So that's where we were today, outside Padrón. We didn't see much of Padrón apart from the Campus Tecnológico de Cortizo. And that's where we spent the whole day. Richard, the start this morning alongside, adjacent to one of the huge, enormous warehouses here. It was our chance, as ever, to catch up with some of the riders. And, well, in our case, we like to try to sort of tie up some loose ends from the previous day, or maybe elaborate on some themes that we've discussed in the previous day's podcast. Now, Richard, yesterday I made what I thought was a very convincing case for Stefan Kung being one of the main players on today's stage, because, as I said, it'd been pretty obvious that Stefan Kung is a guy who is absolutely firing in this Vuelta a España. He's flying. As I said yesterday, he has diamonds in his legs. Now, I thought it would be interesting this morning to just elaborate on this theme with Stefan and to ask him, what does it feel like when one experiences that sort of transcendental state that we like to refer to in cycling simply as form? So we're going to hear from Stefan Kung talk about that this morning. But first, we're going to get a little update, a little check-in with someone who we thought, we suspected, might have a little nibble today on the final climb. I'm talking about Primoz Roglic. So here's old Rog this morning, and then Stefan Kung.
On one end is good, on the other not so. I mean, then you always have a memories how hard it always is. Just a pleasure, I mean, yeah. To come here still year after year, to be capable of, yes, fighting for the best places, fighting with the fastest guys. So, happy. Sunday, yes, was difficult for sure. Went through Monday. I really enjoyed it. When I don't do nothing, I don't really have much pain. Yesterday was a hard start of this week. I don't expect it will go any easier from now on. Just we see how it goes. You just have to have a legs. I mean, it's like that, no? I mean, at least from my side. When you don't have it, it's really hard to do something. When you have it, I mean, it's better to do something than to wait for the moment when you don't have it.
Stefan, I asked you yesterday, was today Wednesday, isn't it, the day? And you sort of said, maybe.
For me, I thought yesterday would be the better day because the climbs were a little bit less steep. And so, I tried a lot to get into that breakaway, but it's always a little bit also playing poker, especially nowadays. A lot of guys who are not that far in the GC try to get in the breaks. And if this happens, then the other teams are going to close it down. So today is another good opportunity. But yeah, as I said, with the steep climbs, it's going to be difficult.
In our show yesterday, I described you as having diamonds in your legs at the moment. I think that's pretty accurate. You're in top form. If someone has never ridden a bike before, knows nothing about cycling, and you had to explain what it's like when you just feel great, describe some of the sensations.
So actually, I can give you an example from yesterday. I was already trying to go into moves before the first climb, and I felt like, I was a bit on the limit, and then we hit the first climb. We were going at a quite hard pace. A lot of riders were dropping. I was able, in this hard pace, to recover and be able to re-jump at the top of the climb. This only happens when you're in good shape. Like, normally, you just like decrease, and you like physically you just go down, 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 down. You just have a little bit more margin. So you also have more margin for errors, but also you recover better every day. Like, just the race itself less puts you under less fatigue. It's even growing. Like, when you're in good shape, able to digest the stages, then you actually like keep getting better through a grand tour, and otherwise you're just decreasing. What happened to me in the tour, like when you're struggling with a little bit of sickness here and there, and then you crash one day, you sleep badly, and then it just adds up. And on the other way around, when you're feeling good and you're in a good run.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about sleeping, because I bet you're sleeping better than you would if you were not in good form.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and also your confidence is high, so like you're in a good mental state. Sleep is a crucial part of it. That's for sure. And the tour, I was sleeping really badly, and I was feeling like my body was just letting go more and more. You have more problems. You have some stomach issues. You have some saddle sores. And when you're in good shape, these kind of things like don't happen. So they must be linked.
Other riders talk about not feeling the chain. Riders talk about feelings like they're floating on air. Some riders say their legs look different. What do you see? What do you feel?
Sometimes you have to impression. It's hard. Like when you look around and you're still feeling good, you're like, then you're always a little bit hesitant. You're like, ah, maybe it's just I'm on a good moment. And then you actually feel like on the day to Granada, or at the beginning of the stage, like, yeah, I was feeling really good and I saw the other guys around me struggling. It keeps going like this through the stage, and then you're like, oh no, actually, it's true. I can trust my feelings. I'm going well. The pedal stroke feels as if you're, like, when you're not in shape or when you're struggling, you have the impression you always have a big gear. You have one gear too big and you shift down, but you're not moving forward. And when you're on good shape, you always have the impression, oh yeah, the chain is light.
We've just put massive pressure on you to win today.
Yeah, I would like to get something out of these good legs, that's for sure.
Richard, you have experienced the phenomenon referred to by Stefan Kung in his peer-reviewed interview with me there.
Yeah, but not on the same, nowhere near the same level, and a sort of fleetingly.
I don't expect you to have been dropping people on Vuelta a España climbs.
No, but much more sort of solo and kind of short-lived, I think. I used to do a bit of competitive rowing when I was a student, and there's a similar thing, I think, when you try and balance the boat and there's all of you who are rowing together trying to synchronize your physical efforts. I can vividly remember that, probably more than cycling actually, where there's that like amazing feeling of that one time in my whole time rowing where the thing was just beautifully balanced and it felt kind of what Stefan was getting on about there. Have you seen any of the King Kung Freunde, everyone's favourite fan club out and about?
The Belgians,
no, yeah.
I never see them at races. No, I'm not sure if they travel anywhere. I don't think I've ever seen them outside Belgium.
No.
In fact, maybe the Tour de France. As I said to Stefan there, I'd put a lot of pressure on him and heaped pressure onto his very broad shoulders ahead of this 11th stage. Let's find out how he got on, shall we? It's time for the tale of the etapa.
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
So Richard, stage 11 of the Vuelta, from the Campus Tecnológico Cortizo Padrón to the Campus Tecnológico Cortizo Padrón. 166 kilometers, 3,131 meters of elevation, 4 climbs, 2 second category climbs, bookended by 2 third cats. The last climb, the Puerto Cruceras summited. 8 kilometers from the finish line, it was terreno rompe piernas, according to Fernando Escartín, former Spanish climber of yesteryear, who is now sort of responsible for route design here at the Vuelta a España. That means it was sort of break your leg terrain. A couple of DNSs this morning. Patrick Conrad of Little Trek, he has COVID, been diagnosed with COVID, as had Timon Arensman. I believe Conrad was suffering from quite unpleasant symptoms, I believe. There was another one. Was it Kobe Hosens? No, Lorenzo Rota was also a DNS for Intermarché. There were attacks on the first climb. Jonathan Narváez was very active, as was Marco Frigo, Louis Meinkes. But nothing really stuck over that first climb. With 122 kilometers to go, we'd reached the halfway point of the Vuelta a España. 1,652 kilometers ridden, 1,652 to go. Victor Campenaert was very jumpy, I would say, as well, in the early phases of the race. He had a couple of goes, but was caught certainly initially with the first one after the first climb. We had Chris Harper abandoning for Jayco Alula, so that they didn't start well for them, but who knows, maybe ended well. There was a very frantic 10 kilometer stretch between 103 kilometers to go, 93 kilometers to go, lots of attacks, and a big group finally formed. Lots of well-known names in there. I'll pick out a few of them. Steven Kruiswijk, Attila Valter, both of Visma, Lisa Bike. Brandon McNulty, Narváez did manage to get away eventually. Verona of Little Trek. A couple of Red Bull riders, including Dani Martinez. Israel were well represented with 3 riders. Marco Frigo, Riquitello, as he likes to be called. Corbin Strong. Campenaerts had made it. Eddie Dunbar. Filippo Zana. Both of those riders for Jayco Alula. Max Poole was in there. Cofidis had 3, including Guillaume Martin. And finally, another 5 riders also made it across in a counter move. Among them was George Bennett. And he would end up, as a result of that counter move, being the best place rider on general classification, because George started the day 9 minutes and 50 seconds behind Ben O'Connor. There was a lone breakout move from that large group. Sandro Maurice of Alpecin De Koenig on the second climb of the day. He struck out on his own. In the peloton, we had Decathlon pulling, and they'd also sort of blocked the road at 92 kilometers ago. So when the brake finally sort of settled around about that point, Richard Carapaz also had a crash, not a high speed crash, but Enric Mas certainly referred to it after the stage as quite a nasty one. Didn't speak to Carapaz, didn't speak to anyone from his team, and he looked okay, so hopefully not too serious. I should have mentioned also that Decathlon, EF and Intermarché and Astana were the only teams with no riders in the break, and that break was being pulled along, dragged along very forcefully, wasn't it, Richard, by Marco Frigo. What a job he did. That was largely because at this point they were thinking about George Bennett's general classification chances. As I said, he was 9 minutes 50 down this morning, but they were also thinking about the stage win. With 38 kilometers to go, Maurice was caught. Sorry, 35 kilometers to go, Maurice was caught. There was another move from Isasa, a very familiar figure in this Vuelta, of Euskaltel. Dents and Gamper of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, they'd been in the escape group, or the lead group. They dropped back with 27.5 kilometres to go. They were on Roglic duty from that point on. We still had that very sizable group coming towards the last climb together. A few riders tried to get a head start. Victor Campenaerts was one of them. He accelerated 15.2 kilometres to go. That didn't work. Then he went again with 10.7 kilometres to go. Took Carlos Verona with him, Mihojlovic, Zana, Berade, Herrada. And on the climb itself, it would be three riders who, well, they were faster than the rest initially. It was Verona, Zana and Berade about halfway up that final climb. Behind them, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe had grouped at the front of the peloton, and they were setting a hard pace into the bottom of the climb, sort of signposting the fact that Primoz Roglic fancied having a go. Well, I mentioned that three-man group they made it over the top of the final climb together, but they wouldn't make it all the way to the finish, because as they came down onto the flat, or onto the plain, around plains, around Padrón, several other riders from that big group who had sort of characterised the day, they made it back to them, including Narváez, McNulty, Eddie Dunbar, and so on and so on. It was, what was it, Richard? 15 riders, maybe, as they sort of came towards the last kilometre. Carlos Verona tried his luck with 1 kilometre to go. He was absorbed. He was gobbled up by the group. And then what happened? Well, Eddie Dunbar shot out of that group like a bullet, like the proverbial bullet, with 600 metres to go. Well, that was the winning move, a surprise winning move. All eyes were on Narváez. And, well, as we might hear later in one of the interviews, Richard, Eddie Dunbar's move, and this is sort of appealing to our older listeners here, it reminded me very much of Oscar Freire in the 1999 World Championships in Verona. Up the right-hand side of the road, just as the sort of group was fanning towards the left, 600 metres to go, identical. Almost identical. Well, Richard, you can tell us. Could you tell us, Richard, what the finishing order was? And give us the top 10, and then I will recap. We'll go back to tell everyone what was happening in the GC group.
I certainly can. Eddie Dunbar in first. A second place for Quinten Hermans second. Max Poole in third. Narváez, who you've mentioned there, one of the favourites, was sort of led the second little group back, just 4 seconds behind the winner in fourth. There was Urco Berade from Equipo Kernfarma in fifth, Filippo Zanna in sixth, Yonny Zagire in seventh, Carlos Verona in eighth, Gianmarco Garofoli in ninth, and Brandon McNulty in tenth. Did you see, Daniel, there was a moment when Yonny Zagire looked like he wanted to do exactly what Dunbar did, but almost 100 metres earlier, when the bunch just did, you know, does that thing coming into the last kilometre where it sort of just swerves from side to side, and his move was curtailed because suddenly all the riders he wanted to jump past just slammed that door in his face, and that opened that gap for Dunbar to attack on the right. It felt like whoever was, I'm not going to say it was a lucky win, but almost whoever had that sort of opportune moment and launched their sprint and had that element of good fortune was going to be able to do that 600 meter sprint that Dunbar did, because it was, that was the, there was no real time for tactics, was there, in that finale? It was of everybody looking at each other, really. It was breathless, wasn't it? And so fast paced, yeah, off that final climb.
Yeah, they were coming in with a lot of speed, and there were a lot of riders in there who didn't really fancy their chances in a sprint. That's not necessarily the case of Eddie Dunbar, because he's quite a fast rider, but he beat them to the punch, didn't he? And we're going to hear from another rider in a minute who had the same idea, but he was, well, beaten to it by Eddie Dunbar. Richard, I promised I would tell everyone what was happening in the GC group. Well, we had the sort of telegraphed Primoz Roglic attack. Only Enric Mas was able to go with him. That was about halfway up the climb. We saw Ben O'Connor struggling. He had Florian Lipovits stuck to his wheel. Lipovits on marking duty, I suppose, for Roglic, although he didn't look as though he really could have gone any faster. Roglic and Mas went towards the summit together. Close to the summit, they were joined by Matthias Schelmoser, Mikel Landa, David Gourdou, and then a late entry, Sugarman, Carlos Rodriguez. And that little, how many riders, how many names did I just give? Was it six? Sextet? However many it was. They then came down the descent together and indeed would finish together. Absentees, notable absentees from that group, Carapaz, Adam Yates as well, Sepp Kuss. So a few riders who are sort of on the fringes of the GC battle and hadn't managed to keep pace and hadn't managed to, well, do what Sugarman did and sort of earn a reprieve either. So, Richard, Roglic, the Roglic group came in finally. It was 3 minutes and 31 seconds behind Dunbar, just over 3 minutes behind, well, George Bennett as well. So what did all of that mean for the general classification? There were some big movers today, Richard. Give us a rundown and try and pick out some losers and winners.
Looking at how many places gained, Carlos Rodriguez jumped up three places by virtue of being in that group of six. Like you said, the Roglic group that made it to the line, he's now sixth overall. Of course, the other big winner, George Bennett, it was 4 minutes and 4 seconds in the end, which brought him up to 10th. Did you manage to speak to George at the end?
We're going to hear from him.
He was sort of phlegmatic about it. But to go back to the GC, that group of six riders gained 37 seconds on Ben O'Connor. That was the main move of the day. In the words of the Vuelta press release, O'Connor loses authority. I wonder whether that, you know, the significance of today's stage is maybe less in the time gap, but more in sort of the augur, the little sense of what's to come over the coming days.
Let's just run down the top 10, shall we? O'Connor obviously still leads in the red jersey. Roglic now 3 minutes 16 behind Mas, 3 minutes 58 behind Carapaz, 4 minutes 10 behind Landa, 4:40. We've then got Sugarman, 5:23, Lipovits, 5:29, Yates, 5:30, Gal is on the same time, and Bennett is just snuck inside the top 10, 5 minutes 46. Richard, just update people as well on the points competition. Wout van Aert still leads that convincingly. King of the Mountains, Adam Yates still leads, although he's equal on points with Wout van Aert. And Sugarman has leapfrogged Lipovits in the white jersey competition. He'll be wearing that tomorrow, the white jersey. Richard, you mentioned George Bennett. He was a winner and the loser today. We're going to hear from him first in our roundup of some of the riders who are in the thick of things today. We're going to hear from Bennett, then Roglic, and then finally, we're going to hear from Roglic's direct sportif, Patxi Vila, about whether it was a good day indeed for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe.
Well, George, looks like a really good day for you on GC. Fantastic performance by Frigo and Corbin, but it seems like you wanted more.
Oh, mate, we wanted to win the stage, and I thought I had it all lined up, and in he went, and I just got so closed, and it was exactly what I was trying to do, you know, and he just did it well, and yeah, I'm really disappointed because you saw how well the boys worked. They put everything in for me. Mate, Frigo is... It's hard to explain how strong that guy is. All day, it was just... He pulled that whole thing. I would say he did 98% of that. And we were just so fast, and I was on the wheels just dying. But yeah, I'm really disappointed that I couldn't pay back the boys. Corbin also, they all just went all in for me. And that group got away before the climb, and then we went really fast up the climb and just got back to them. And yeah, I mean, can't help but feel particularly disappointed right now. But yeah, anyway.
We talked the other day about this snakes and ladders game. We sort of said that, well, you might find yourself on the right end of it one day, and sure enough, it happened today.
Well, yeah, I'm just trying to work that out. They're at 1K to go, maybe 3.5 minutes. Probably not enough, you know. I needed like 6 or 7, so I was hoping for a bit more time than that, but it's better than nothing.
Maybe you're going to be in the top 10 now. I mean, does that matter for you? It sounds like the stage win was going to be more important for the team today.
Yeah, I mean, top 10. It'd be nice if, you know, early in your career and stuff, you get a nice top 10, it'd be really cool. And exciting. No, I wouldn't turn my nose up at it, but I'd much rather win a stage. I've never won a stage, and we'll be looking for more opportunities in the next 10 days or however many left. Yeah, it was horrible. No one helped us. No one had GC guys there apart from us, so like we were the only ones that... In fact, it was the opposite. A lot of guys had GC guys in their peloton, and they were actively slowing it down, and it was just a horrible dynamic. That whole group was just shit-ass, completely shit-ass from the start. And if it wasn't for Marco and Corbin and Matthew, we wouldn't have probably stayed away, to be honest.
I always say it's better to gain something than you lose, huh? Still quite some 35 seconds to go, no? Definitely happy. I mean, happy with how it went, how I had the legs, and especially as happy about the guys. I mean, showed nice racing, and at the end, I mean, sometimes you win a bit, sometimes you lose, but as long as we are executing the way we want it, I mean, it's a win for us, definitely.
What's another super hectic start, and the idea was to just watch out to big groups and see if we can actually just to get into that last climb. That was my biggest fear, just to have enough power there. Lucky to put lucky, you know, they were good to put Lucky and Nico and Gamp in the front group to have that run into that last climb, to get it completely right in the front, and then just hit it from there and see what happened. It's important that we start catching back sometime here and there. I mean, with some road maths, I would say at least, you know, you start coming back. That's the important thing, you know. Yesterday we were equal. If today again you're equal, then it's one less day. So I think it's just we are just not panicking at all. We are just sticking to our strategy and just moving forward.
Primo says his back's not 100% better. Are you having to sort of adapt your plans every day to what he says about how his back is feeling?
We have a plan. We just think, okay, this is how we want to race. But at the end, it's the last call is up to him, you know. If he doesn't feel it, of course, he will not go for it. So that's kind of course, we just plan everything like his back was okay or he's okay. He's riding the bike and he has the last call.
Who do you feel is the favourite of the Vuelta now, 11 stages in? Are you feeling as though momentum's tipping back in your favour a little bit?
I think the focus is wrong right now. I think where most of people has the focus is wrong. I would tell not more than that, but I think the focus is in the wrong place. Let's look backwards. I mean, if you look who's there, who's always there, then it's pretty easy. So I think the focus has to be in another place. Yeah.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here at Podcast HQ to tell you that this episode of our Vuelta coverage is sponsored by Bravour Watches. Now, as everybody knows, Grand Tours are races of hours, minutes and seconds, and the clock doesn't stop until the riders hit the finish line. And inconveniently for some, the watch never lies. This is the absolute perfect partnership for cycling fans because Bravour is a Swedish luxury watch brand that's deeply rooted in the history, heritage and iconography of professional cycling. And while the Vuelta is going on, all Cycling Podcast listeners can get an exclusive 15% discount on all watches by going to bravourwatches.com and using the discount code CYCLE at checkout. Bravour watches combine precision Swiss engineering with elegant Swedish design, and there are several ranges inspired by professional cycling. Most notably, the Grand Tour chronograph range is inspired by the three Grand Tours, including the Vuelta, of course, and there are elegant but subtle nods to cycling's history on all of the designs. For example, the colours are inspired by the race leaders' jerseys. The number 13 on the minute track is upside down, just like the riders wear on their jerseys. And La Grande Boucle, the Tour de France-inspired design, has the 12 o'clock marker, which is inspired by those yellow and white milestones that you find on French climbs. There's also a new Team Heritage range, which was launched earlier this year, and the designs echo the golden age of cycling from the 50s to the 80s, inspired by the Peugeot, Mercia and Renault teams, and pro cycling aficionados will immediately spot the connections when you have a look at the website. One of Bravo's ambassadors is Kevin Genietz of the Groupama FDJ team. He's actually riding the Vuelta as we speak. You might spot him in the peloton with the watch on his wrist, because Bravo watches are designed to be worn on or off the bike. So a reminder of that 15% discount for all of our listeners as long as the Vuelta is going on. So you've got a couple of weeks to check out the designs and make your choice by going to bravowatches.com and using the discount code CYCLE at checkout.
Well, Richard, interesting from, well, Patchy Villa trying to be cryptic, but making it pretty obvious, I think pretty obvious, that he was talking about Enric Mas now being the biggest threat to Primoz Roglic. And it's hard to argue, isn't it, based on what we saw today, although Ben O'Connor does still have a healthy lead, and I must say in his press conference still seemed pretty relaxed, and that lead, we'll just remind people, 3 minutes and 16 seconds. But Mas looking ominous. I mean, he even took the odd pull on the front today. What on earth is going on?
He did look good, didn't he? And as soon as Roglic went, he was sort of glued on his wheel, wasn't he, almost to the point where you couldn't see him from the photographer on the back of the motorbike. So close was he. But yeah, I was impressed by Mas. It's a funny kind of time gap, isn't it, for O'Connor as well. Over 3 minutes still, but he's got so much to play with. You sense it could almost lull him into a slight, not a false sense of security, but today wasn't a great day in terms of losing 37 seconds. At what point does the time gap become small enough that Roglic and Mas sort of become favourites for the title and O'Connor slips down that standing? I don't really know. I still really rate his chances. I think, you know, the talk of numbers afterwards, after the stage, particularly on that final climb, were people doing their best or second best or top 10 5 minute power effort, and it was a short climb. I think David Gaudu's just got the Strava KOM at 7 minutes 44, the final climb, which isn't really O'Connor's strength, is it? More of a longer climb, higher mountains specialist, so not the end of the world for him.
No, they are chipping away though, aren't they? You know, Patchy Villa told us straight away, as soon as Ben O'Connor took the jersey and had that large gap, I mean, it's worth reminding ourselves and everyone else, it was 4 minutes and 51. So how many days ago was that? Was that last, feels like it was last
stage
Thursday,
six, wasn't it,
or Friday? Yes. So it's come down, you know, a minute 40, and it's felt a bit tortuous, the process, it certainly hasn't been smooth sailing for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. It hasn't felt linear, but if you'd asked them last, or if I'd asked Patchy Villa, or I'd put it to Patchy Villa last Thursday or whenever it was, that, you know, not even a week on, it would be down to 3:15, then I suppose he'd be fairly happy. I think in the back of his mind and Mas's mind and Primoz Roglic's mind, they probably hoped that Ben O'Connor would collapse. And I think as the days have gone on, and they've also seen how strong Decathlon are, and how much like a sort of seasoned, practiced GC team they have ridden, I think that hope has sort of faded slightly. I think, I mean, it might still happen. He could still implode, but he doesn't look like, he looks quite solid at the moment.
He does. I mean, two things there. Firstly, I think that time gap, you can scratch over a minute off that in terms of what O'Connor, if everybody rides to form, I know this is difficult to say at the end of a 3 week Grand Tour, but if everybody rides to form in that final time trial, you would expect Roglic to put at least a minute into O'Connor there, so that brings it to sort of pretty close to 2 minutes if you assume that on the final stage. The other thing, you know, what kind of happened today was that Decathlon did so much of the work just controlling that breakaway, not really reeling it in and making much of a dent in that time gap, but just making sure it didn't get out of hand. But the fact that they did most of the work meant that what Red Bull could do was chuck numbers at the bottom of that final climb and tee up that Roglic move. I do think Decathlon are strong, but that's almost counting against them at the moment because the other teams can just let them do that work. The time gap is big enough that they don't really feel too compelled to do that at the moment or to contribute, but then they're ready there. Red Bull today, next day it might be Movistar, to do something on their own. And I think at that point, O'Connor was isolated and Decathlon were kind of burnt up. And that could be a problem for them if this template, what we saw today, is going to carry on for the next few days.
It was sort of intriguing that Movistar decided to commit one man to the chase at one point, Nelson Oliveira. And unless I missed something, I don't think that Red Bull Bora did ever commit anyone to the chase. And I presume, because Movistar had guys in the break, and they didn't send them back. Red Bull Bora did send Dens and Gamper back. I presume that was about protecting Mass's podium position currently from George Bennett. But I might be wrong.
How much do you think tactics and back scratching is going on here? You know, we'll chuck a guy out in the chase, sort of lend a hand, be your friend today, and then maybe in the coming days that favor will be repaid. Do you think there's a bit of that going on as well?
Possibly. Certainly Israel didn't do, we talked about Decathlon there, and this, maybe there will be some attrition over the course of, you know, a week, or if it goes many more days, you know, you'll be talking about them having defended the jersey for 10 days and that will start to take its toll. Certainly Israel didn't make it easy for them today. They had a real race on their hands. And George Bennett getting across, I think after they blocked the road, so they blocked the road with 93 kilometres to go. I'm trying to think whether, I'm wondering whether Bennett was one of those riders. There were a couple of riders that snuck around the side of the sort of blockade, just made it over the drawbridge. That was effectively George Bennett getting across. That was what made the day a lot more difficult than it probably, well, than Decathlon probably wanted it to be, because they wouldn't have been worried about Guillaume Martin. He was another three minutes back on general classification. But Bennett just put a little bit of anxiety in their mind, I think.
Should we talk about Eddie Dunbar?
We should. We should talk about the stage winner.
I can remember in 2015, bookies were taking odds on I can't remember how old he was there in 2015, 9 years ago, on the odds on him winning a stage or the overall at the Tour de France. He was a junior or first year under 23. I think still a junior at that point. Such was the sort of the potential. I think a few riders have been summed up by the word potential, I think, in the last decade or so than Eddie Dunbar, and finally got his, well, it's not a Tour de France stage win, so there's perhaps some punters in Ireland who have only got a year to get that Tour de France stage win, but a Grand Tour stage win for Dunbar at last. It's felt kind of a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, and he went a few years at Ineos Grenadiers when he wasn't getting any opportunities. In fact, did he ever ride any Grand Tours for Ineos Grenadiers? I seem to remember interviewing him.
I'm not sure, but I think that was one of the reasons for him moving to Jayco Alula, wasn't it? Was the lack of opportunities he was getting there at Ineos.
Yeah, and he's had a lot of injuries. He's had a lot of bad luck in recent months. Today, it sounded as though, well, he, like everyone else, was watching Narvaez, and he decided that he had one shot. I mean, I mentioned earlier that he was pretty confident in his sprint, but I'm not sure how confident he would have been against Narvaez, and it was a pretty instinctive move. In fact, just to find out how instinctive it was and whether any instructions were coming from the team car, whether it was planned at all, let's hear from his direct sportif today, Valerio Piva, who was in the car for Jayco Alula.
His plan, you know, we come to this Vuelta with the ambition, Eddie was our GC rider, and the start was a little bit difficult. He lost some time in one of the first stage, so then we change a little bit the tactic and we say the only way is try to win a stage and go in the breakaway, maybe come back with some minutes in GC, and that was the plan. He was feeling good the last day, a little bit fresh here on the north, and Today he was in with Zana, it was perfect move. Okay, the rest, he did an amazing attack in the final kilometer. Ale, he's not a really sprinter, he's strong in the sprint, but he was the best tactic to anticipate the sprint, and he won, and I'm also very happy for him because he's a professional guy, he's really busy and motivated. So that changed everything now.
It was like Oscar Freire in Verona in 1999. Everyone was watching Narváez, everyone went to the left of the road, and he went up the right.
Yeah, he was really clever for that because you cannot say in the radio. I say, guys, Zana was in the move, he was a block the whole day helping. I told him, look, Narváez in the climb. I was thinking Narváez, maybe he was trying to repeat the attack from Torino in the Giro, but he was cool, and then he did the move in the right moment, and everybody looked Narváez, and he was going, and amazing to see, yeah.
Well, Richard, it hadn't been a particularly happy Vuelta until this point for Jayco Alula, but a fantastic victory for them and Eddie Dunbar today. And you would like to think, you would hope that Eddie Dunbar would take a lot of confidence from this and maybe, take his sort of riding, helped by some better luck, to a different dimension, really, because he's a guy who sometimes you feel, and he said this as well, much like another Irishman, Sam Bennett, who seems to lack a little bit of self-confidence and self-belief. And this is a sport, unfortunately, that will wear away your self-belief. Certainly if you're handed as much misfortune as Eddie Dunbar has been on the wrong end of over the last few years.
Yeah, and the last year in particular, I think he said at his interview after the stage that he's had 7 or 8 crashes since this time last year, the Vuelta in 2023. He damaged his ligaments in his knee in the Giro this year on stage 2, and alluded to the fact that he thought, well, that might actually be it for his career as a cyclist. And to come back from that, not only the bad luck, but the sort of mental element, questioning whether you have a future in the sport, that's quite a turnaround, really, isn't it? He didn't go to the Tour, did he? But nevertheless, to come back from the Giro and turn things around that quickly after that number of crashes can easily linger with a rider for quite a long time, can't they?
Yeah, I'm just looking at his results from this year. He had 5 DNFs or DNSs in the first 5 months of the year. I spoke to a rider this morning who was in the break today, Guillaume Martin, who's had 2 DNFs since 2018. And Guillaume Martin is exceptional, and he holds various records for never DNFing races. But still, to have 5 in the first 5 months of the year, effectively, that sort of sums up what an uphill battle it's been for Eddie Dunbar of late. But really good to see him get that win, and in sort of unexpected fashion as well. Richard, I propose... I was going to propose that we finish this second part by talking about, or at least talking to, another Irishman. Because I suppose, unbeknownst to many people, one of the key figures in this Vuelta a España, or in the destiny of this Vuelta a España, who might win this Vuelta a España, it could be an Irishman. Because Ben O'Connor's coach hails from the Emerald Isle, shall we say. I think he's from Cork, actually. He's a gentleman named Stephen Barrett, and I thought that it would be instructive to talk to Stephen about how Ben got here, that is, how he prepared for the Vuelta, just how impressive that ride to Junquera last week when he took the red jersey was, and how confident their camp are about him holding on to this red jersey all the way to Madrid. So it was quite a long conversation, so we're going to split it into 2 parts. And here it is, Stephen Barrett talking to me on the phone this morning. He's not at the race yet, about his pupil, charge, Ben O'Connor.
It's an interesting point because I think a lot of the discourse is often like, okay, how the peloton gave him too much time, or the peloton allowed him to get this time. And that is true to an extent. But actually, you dig into the numbers, what Ben did that day was quite impressive. And it was almost akin to what he did in 2021 when he won the stage in the Tour on Ting. And most important part of that day was, what we didn't see on TV, was the power he put out to get in the break. I think what people didn't realize is actually how hard the first 2 hours of that race were. I mean, the first 2 hours were extremely, extremely hard. Ben did one of his all-time best 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 20-minute efforts just to kind of establish the break weapon. Yeah, when the break was established and he got away with the DSM rider, he just rode at a very strong tempo the rest of the day. And you know, when you look at the last year and how bike race has gone, we see these long wedge attacks. You see Pogacar, what he did in Strade Bianche. We see what Remco has done. So we kind of see it's possible, but I think there was such a big fatigue built up in the peloton, and yeah, when Bin did so following houring, it was more or less around thresholds, so give or take 400 watts. And in that type of terrain, no matter how fast you're going behind, it's going to be hard to pull back a lot of time. So of course, a little bit of the day was the peloton gave him a little bit too much string, but then he capitalized and maximized on it by having a very, very good day.
It's kind of part of your job, Stephen, to take emotion out of things. But one of the things that kept coming up in interviews with other riders in the subsequent days was that, well, Ben himself said it, he's an emotional rider, whatever that means. Would you subscribe to that? Has it translated over the time that you've worked with Ben? Has it translated into his performances as well?
I think often Ben is being sometimes incorrectly described as being overly emotional. That's just Ben's nature. He expresses himself, which is a very good thing to do. It's a very healthy thing to do. I think sometimes in professional sports, we expect athletes to be like robots, and especially in cycling, which is such a numerical sport. Ben, and that's what makes his teammates want to work for him, because he shows emotion. And I think it's something that I suppose we learned to kind of control in the last 3 or 4 years with him. I think, Bob, what you guys saw on Netflix was, okay, it was quite a bit dramatized. Some of it is true, and I think that sums bare character, but yeah, a lot of it was a bit dramatized. But what makes Ben is that, you know, he sometimes rides in emotion. I think you saw that how the day he won was. There was a lot of emotion behind that, in the sense of, okay, I'm going to show you guys what I can do. And Ben is always trying to improve himself. I think Ben is often seen not as like in the top GC guys in the world. It's strange, because Ben has showed glimpses of that in the last couple of years particularly, and there's a little bit of that, yeah, Aussie chip on the shoulder. I was, okay, I'll show you. And once you can manage that and control that in a certain way, yeah, he can do some pretty special things.
The heat has obviously been a real feature of this Vuelta, or it was for the few days before and a few days after that ride. How much work had Ben done in the run-up to this Vuelta on heat adaptation? We know that all the GC guys do something nowadays, but how much had Ben done?
It's quite interesting, because it's something that we know is extremely important, like for all GC guys now. It's not just... The heat stuff is not just important when you're racing hot climates, but even just general has an impact on performance is quite important to do. I actually remember when Ben bought his house in Andorra a few years ago, would he put a sauna in it or not? And in the end, he put a sauna into it, which has been a useful thing, because when he's at home now, he can do some extra sauna sessions, which have been very, very useful. In the 4 or 5 weeks before the Vuelta, he kind of planned training sessions to go on certain climbs in Andorra, which he'll be exposed to more heat, which really helps. You know, it's quite funny. I remember he was talking to Larry, your very own Motan Moistro at San Sebastian, and Larry is like a huge proponent of it. Like, Larry takes things to another level, where Larry is like in his pants suit in his back garden in the east of 40 degrees C.
Yeah.
You've seen him. So, but like, Larry has seen a significant impact in his performance on that. For Ben, that's a bit OTT. Of course, it's quite funny to see how the two of them will discuss it. And you know, we did in the 4 weeks before the Vuelta, he did a lot of specific climbing in hot temperatures, on hot climbs, alongside the sauna stuff he was doing at home as well. So yeah, it was an important part of his preparation.
I mean, the preparation he did for the Vuelta, I mean, it was good preparation. It was kind of comprehensive as well. You know, there are various other GC guys here who you get the impression, I mean, because of they've had things go wrong, or they have sort of not fudged their preparation together, but they've had to kind of do a fast track preparation, but that doesn't seem to be the case with Ben. It sounds, from what you're saying, as though, well, you were happy with it, he was happy with it, and he was ready to ride GC here.
It was. I think that's also a testament to the team and allowing us to have autonomy in how we did the preparation. And because after the Giro, Ben also had a new baby girl, Josephine, yeah, which you know, allowed him to spend some more time at home, and he didn't go to the altitude training camp with the team, which we had in team. So a lot of the Vuelta guys would have been there. Also, actually, the plan was he does Burgos and Vuelta, and he actually got called into the Olympics at the last moment because of Luke collapse crash. So we actually had to do some last-minute alterations. We took him out of Burgos, and he did Olympics and then in San Sebastian. And that was a bit of a risk, because with Burgos, you're exposed to the heat, so you can do TT there, and you get to race with your teammates. But yeah, again, because the team had conference in Sports Online, and in Ben, he allowed us to, okay, how can we make the preparations as good as possible? And, you know, he's been at home, you know, once he finished the Giro, he had, you know, a long stint at home. And in the end, it's worked out quite well. He had a good day at the Olympics. He was better at Sandsept. And then he's coming to the world thing in good shape. So it's, this is something that I always said to Ben, is I think it's important for us to reflect on these things, what's worked, what didn't work. But he was saying himself, says, I think we've learned a lot in the last 3-4 years working together. And I think, yeah, it's quite nice that the last 4 or 5 weeks of work is being fruitful. We went into the GR this year with the podium as the goal. I think we went into the Vuelta. The team objective was top five, but between me and Ben, it was more, okay, I think you could do podium, because we see the numbers, we saw what he did, and it was maybe a bit between us of what he could do. And yeah, like you said, we're at a situation now where he's in a red jersey and, you know, he's having fun, he's enjoying us, but it's a new challenge for him as well. So we're just taking it, he's taking it day by day. And like you said, he'll see where story takes him in the next few days.
La Vuelta Sartorial. The Sartorial Vuelta.
Well, Richard, this is the Vuelta Sartorial, Sartorial Vuelta, in which we dig out, unstitch, critique clothing artifacts of Vueltas a España of yesteryear. Richard, I've supplied you with a photograph. That was your homework for this edition of the Vuelta Sartorial. And what can you see on the photo that I sent you earlier?
Well, I can see top German sprinter of yesteryear, Eric Zabel.
What's he wearing?
He's wearing, do you remember back in the day, you used to get those, I want to call, they weren't crisps, but they weren't really biscuits either. They were like kind of what mini cheddars are, but they were called fish and chips. And some were...
International audience, Richard. I'm not sure the fish and chips empire stretched across all five main continents.
Well, anyway, you used to get chips, which were just thin rectangles of biscuit crisp. And then you get these little fish cutouts that were very basic fish shaped. And that is what Eric Zabel is wearing, is a fish and chips without the chips jersey. What kind of blue would that be?
It's a sort of azure blue, isn't it? Or a lightish blue with yellow fishes.
This must be pre-2006.
So it's 2004, I can tell you. This was, so what we're looking at is the points jersey. Interestingly, in the Vuelta, they call it, I believe they still call it the Vuelta, the Maillot de la Regularidad, which is the consistency jersey. They don't call it the points jersey. And yes, between 2004 and 2006, it had this rather fetching design, as we said, blue with yellow little fishes on it. And that was because the competition was sponsored by, well, the acronym was FROM, and the long name was Fondo de Regulación y Ordenación del Mercado de los Productos de la Pesca y Cultivos Marinos. Basically, fishing ministry. What do you call it in England? The Ministry of Fisheries?
Yeah, it's probably got another long, convoluted title, but yeah.
Yeah, and they decided to promote the consumption of fish, particularly among young people, by sponsoring the points jersey, the regularity jersey.
The well-known young demographic that follow professional cycling.
Yeah, and this did cause a bit of a stir at the time, which is, I suppose, what they wanted. I was reading some articles today, people, sort of journalists, questioning the good taste of the design. One of them put it to one of the head honchos at Unipublic, who were the race organisers back then and still well involved in the race organisation now, that it was a strange design. And the reply came back, well, if a sponsor wants to see a rider in a lizard skin, then frankly, we will do it. That's what the jersey will look like. So as I said, 2004-2006, it was won by Eric Zabel the first year, Alessandro Petacchi the next year, and Tor Husov the next year. Now, we were thinking about sponsors today, obviously, because of where the stage was starting and finishing. Richard, the Vuelta has a sort of long and, well, illustrious, I'm not sure it's that illustrious, history of starting stages in or adjacent to factories, doing sponsors a favour, effectively. There's our good friend, my good friend, Juanfran de la Cruz, who is a sort of welter historian, writes a lot about the welter of the history. He published a nice list earlier today on X, formerly Twitter. There was a start in a Ford factory in 2006. They've been in starts in just malls, sort of general malls, because the sponsor had a shop in the mall. There was there's been starts at wineries, Faustino the Fifth Winery, El Pozo, of course, the big sort of processed meat plant outside Murcia. I actually asked Ben O'Connor this morning what he thought about starting an aluminium factory, and he said, well, at least it's not that meat factory. I think he was referring to El Pozo, but he didn't actually name them. So we'll have to assume, or we'll have to presume innocence, should anyone come at him with a meat cleaver on behalf of El Pozo. But yes, that has been our day in the Cortizo aluminium plant. But Richard, interesting interview with Stephen Barrett. We heard earlier Ben O'Connor's coach. As I said, we'll hear the second part tomorrow. But yeah, I thought quite illuminating, particularly about just how fantastic that ride was to Junquera, and how maybe, and you know, we've been guilty of this as well, and people haven't really been giving it and Ben O'Connor the credit he has deserved.
Yeah, and you know, I spent some of the day going back to past interviews with Ben O'Connor, and something that kind of struck me about most recent stuff he's said or has written is this sense of kind of perspective and context with stuff. You know, something, and a quote here from something he wrote for Ruler magazine earlier this year, which was, being a pro here is something me and my wife love and cherish, and we're having a hell of a time, but I know when it's all over and the dust settles, we'll move back to Perth because it's the best place in the world. I love my job. I'm striving to be the best version of myself, but I also know this is just a moment in my life. And it's quite, I don't know, that sort of stuck with me, that sense of perspective.
I wish I had that kind of perspective.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's all very well saying that in the off season, but whether he is feeling that right now, I don't quite know, because you read other stuff about Ben O'Connor, certainly that includes input from Julien Jourdi or Vincent Lavenu. Jourdi, his sports director at the Tour, Lavenu until very recently. Well, what exactly was Lavenu at Decathlon? Ultimate boss, but he was the founder who's been pushed out. But, you know, the Ben O'Connor they talk about is the kind of emotional rider who's yelling expletives into the team radio when stuff's not going his way in Grand Tours. I don't quite know what Ben O'Connor we're going to see in the coming days. You know, we were talking about Eddie Dunbar there in the previous bit and Jaco Alula. And whenever I see O'Connor riding, I can't help but remember or be reminded of the fact that he's going to be riding for Jaco next year. And I wonder if there's a sense of wanting to go out on a high, but also he doesn't have a relationship with Decathlon to be concerned about or to consider after this year. You know, there's potentially something quite liberating in where he finds himself now, that the chance to start again to a degree next year when he joins Jaco, to go out on a high and maybe just to sort of, obviously winning the Vuelta is what he's aiming for, but you know, a sense of, I suppose, living in the moment. He said something at the end of today. He was asked whether he was worried after shedding, what was it, 37 seconds. And he said some, you know, words to the effect of, well, I'm not happy, but I couldn't do anything about it. I think it's quite a lot to admire there, that sort of maturity and perspective.
Yeah, I've been impressed with his team as well. And, well, I talked yesterday about the different sort of blends of characters and levels of experience at the Red Bull Bora team. I actually spoke to Nico Denz about that this morning, and he sort of said, well, Nico Dentz, he's one of the more vocal ones, and then you've got Roglic as well, who's obviously providing his input. But I like the blend at Decathlon. They're sort of grown-up riders. There are guys there, you know, not necessarily all old riders, but you've got someone like Felix Gall, who when you speak to him has great poise and is very calm, and I presume that he's also quite calm and considered in a team environment. And you've got guys like Bouchard and even Vincent Lafay as well, who have been around for quite a long time in professional cycling, seen quite a lot. Okay, they may not have been in this exact position before, but I think they've looked a very cohesive unit, Almirai as well. So I think that will give Ben O'Connor definitely a sense of security as well. But ultimately, as Primoz Roglic says, it's about the legs, huh? And it is. Primoz is
security until the meat factory.
Yeah.
The hired goons from the meat factory come and exact their revenge.
Exactly. Richard, we should talk about tomorrow's stage.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So Richard, yesterday's dinner, we were in Vigo, not a city I know that well. A city that's quite difficult to know actually, because it's a strange sort of configuration. Absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous setting. Looking out over the Atlantic, the Galician coastline is really something to behold, but it's quite an industrial place. It reminds me a bit of Genoa in Italy, just with the huge sort of ports that really dominate the city. And we had a lovely meal as well, actually. I had sort of a smoked panna cotta. It was kind of fancy pants, sort of modern, sort of fusion cooking. And I had a sort of smoked savory panna cotta with some tomatoes and pumpkin seeds and a few different herbs, and it was really, really delicious. It doesn't sound that delicious, but it was. And I had the obligatory glass of Albariño, because that part of the world, or just inland from Vigo, is very well known for its white wine, and it's Albariño in particular. So that was rather splendid. Very much enjoyed my time in Vigo. I had a run up to the fort overlooking the city, or sort of there's a kind of a snack exclusively sold in the United Kingdom earlier. This is a bit like a walnut whip, if you remember those, like a conical
those.
Sort of chocolate. Well, how would you describe it, Richard? Praline. Anyway, it's
had like whipped cream in the middle, didn't
yeah
it?
It's
kind of creamy something,
yeah, like a sort of wizard's hat sticking out the middle of Vigo, and there's a fort perched on the top which offers fantastic views in, well, both north and south along that coastline I just mentioned. So a very interesting city if you're ever in that part of the world. Tomorrow we are still in Galicia, and we've got another uphill finish. We're starting in Ourense, and we are finishing, or the race is finishing, at the Estación de Montaña de Manzaneda. The climb, I'll just give you the details. It is 15.4 kilometers long. The average gradient is 4.7%. However, that is slightly deceiving, because particularly the last 3 kilometers, or certainly kilometers 14 and 15, are pretty difficult. 7% average kilometer 14, and 8.1% average for kilometer 15. So there's this thing in the tail, as it were, looks ripe for roglification. Probably not hard enough for Enric Mas to think that it's going to suit him more than it will suit Roglic, and it may be an opportunity for him to, well, justify, vindicate exactly what Pachi Vila hinted to us earlier, that he is the real man to watch. He's the real danger in this Vuelta a España. Should also mention that the terrain in the first part of the stage, or the first three quarters of the stage, looks very gnarly, typically Galician. Well, lots of ups and downs, no classified climbs, interestingly, but I think the riders at the end of the day will probably bemoan that fact, or think that it was slightly ridiculous there were no more classified climbs, because it looks as though there are some nasty sections of several kilometres uphill, and in some places quite steep.
3,000 metres of climbing, just over, again. It's kind of standard for a Vuelta, especially up there, isn't it? But I think there'll be quite a lot to look out for tactically for the riders that isn't really marked on the roadbook. Kind of one of those stages that will reward studious sports directors or riders having a good look at the roadbook tonight and figuring out exactly what they're going to do about tomorrow.
That bonus sprint as well. There are bonus seconds available. It's 100, kilometre 101. I just wonder, that's at the top of one of these unclassified climbs. On the roadbook, it looks as though it's around a 4 or 5 kilometer climb. So that's at kilometer 101, and the final climb starts at kilometer 122. But the terrain is very undulating in that sort of section of tomorrow's course, and it may be that the race is very much on already at that point. And certainly the race will be on to sort of get into the bottom of that final climb in a good position, or the stress levels will be rising. And I just wonder about those bonus seconds as well. I don't think we're necessarily at the point of the race where Roglic et al. Think that this Vuelta is going to be a question of bonus seconds. But who knows? I would keep your eye on, or I would certainly be tuned in in time to see that bonus sprint after 101 kilometres. Richard, should we leave it there for this evening?
We shall, yeah. Where are you off to tonight, Daniel?
I'm staying in a lovely sort of eco, rural hacienda that I've stayed in before, actually. Sort of halfway towards tomorrow's start. And yeah, not the easiest part of the world for me gastronomically. There was actually a bit of a controversy in my research about Pimientos de Padrón. There was a Spanish soap star called Clara Lago who was filming in Galicia recently, and she did an interview in which she said that as a vegan it was impossible to eat in Galicia, and all she'd been eating for 4 months were Pimientos de Padrón, and this caused outrage in Galicia, and she was the subject of torrents of abuse. Not quite career ending for highlighting the fact that Pimientos de Padrón were pretty much the only option for vegans. But yes, I won't labour that point. I'm sure there will be some Pimientos de Padrón, and I'll just have to find something else for my main course. But yeah, I'll report back on that tomorrow. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Daniel. Till tomorrow.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.